Hi, everybody. Just a couple introductory remarks. Well,
other people may or may not be coming in. Somebody asked why this is the seat that I use, and Jason used last night, and people seem to sit in it when they're going to speak. It's mostly that they're extremely uncomfortable. Having had them at Holden Village for 25 years in 1982, we found a whole bunch of them for our restaurant, and they worked really well because people would actually leave. After about an hour, it's sort of like, I think, oh yeah. Anyway, they're just fine for a while. They're tall captain's chairs, and I think it's because the captain didn't ever sit down very long.
You know, in restaurants, they specially design the chairs that they're only comfortable for a little while.
Well,
that the chairs will, people will leave.
They do that, do they, Linda? Well, anyway, I guess we did. On Monday, we talked. The question was from Genesis 3, God strolling in the garden and asks, Adam, where are you? And what have you done? And the answer was, I'm hiding. And I'm scared. Yesterday, we ended up asking God, where are you? Where are you, God? And that's what the disciples were asking in Mark 4. Jesus is sitting in the stern on a pillow, asleep at the tiller, so to speak, and they're saying, don't you know, don't you know, we're going to drown? And that's the question that Mark's community seemed to be asking a lot. I was just mentioning that to Nancy Winder, and she said, oh, in Mark, the disciples are always scared. And that's what was happening in Mark's time, 30 years after the crucifixions. 50 years after the crucifixion and resurrection, people were still scared. At the end, though, we also found that, what have you done? Asking God, what have you done? Turning the tables on God. God's on the cross. And that's what God has done. God changed from being powerful to being weak. God changed from being the king. We know where the king is in Mark. It's written over Jesus' head on the cross. That's the king. And we also have to be careful of those kingly language, using those kingly terms, unless we always remember where Jesus is, in fact, reigning from. Today, we're going to continue on our stroll, which we interrupted a little bit, thanks to Thomas, Christian, and some others who had said, well, tell this story or tell that story. So, anyway, so we did. And the challenge is we're still trying to walk. And remember that God propels Adam and Eve out of the garden, keeps a fiery sword in front so they can't go back to the garden. And an interesting thing in Genesis 3, those of you who want to read that, God not only propels them, but he clothes them in skins. So somebody had to die so that he could put them in those animal skins. Those the night before, according to Milton, Adam and Eve went hand in hand, into their bower and did not have to worry about removing what Milton calls these troublesome disguises. These troublesome disguises. Remember that line? Anyway, these troublesome disguises which we wear. W-E-E, we wear. But and Milton saw that it was a disguise. Augustine saw it was a disguise. St. Paul saw it. It's a disguise. Remember from Galatians 6. People who are trying to change you into something are trying to make you play a part. And Augustus knew this at his death. You know, he looks in the mirror, combs his hair, and basically says, ring down the curtain. But I played my part well. They knew they were playing parts, those ancients. And that's part of our challenge. Because we have to go forward kind of naked into the world with good courage. I found a quote by Anne Lamott that I really like. It says that courage is fear that has said its prayers. Courage is fear that has said its prayers. And today when people are leaving Holden Village, you know, we say you go out with good courage. But it can be really fearful. We had a friend who was up at Koinonia this summer. We were so thankful for Holden Village all summer long because we had five staff who'd been at Holden Village. And you know, the amazing thing is, they knew how to work. And they knew how to be part of a worshiping community. And when you're in a place that is supposedly part of the church, Evangelical Lutheran Church, Lutheran Outdoor Ministries, and yet has lost its ability to worship. It was so great to have. I felt like we were getting, you know, just every day we were getting huge amounts of vitamins and minerals and protein. But one of the five was really, really concerned about what was going to happen after Koinonia, a.k.a. going back to Minnesota and Wisconsin. And it was just a daily battle to, you know, oh no, 1st of September is coming up. So I would always tell her, oh, the state fair will come up before then. You know, you don't have to worry about what happens afterwards. That didn't help. Anyway, but Luther, another quote that I found in a Bach book, and it's a Bultmann quoting Luther, and I have never seen this Luther quote, but I really like this about what faith is, because we say, give us faith to go out with good courage. And so I've just given you the courage quote, fear that has said its prayers. And here's the Luther quote that Luther says, faith is the readiness to enter confidently into the darkness of the future. Enter confidently into the darkness of the future. And when you think about how much we need light, and Luther saw that readiness to enter confidently into the darkness of the future. Well, we've been asked to stroll out into this world by Jesus, and the challenge for us is how even to get up off our butts and do something. The two poems I wanted to look at just for a moment, because they're both such great poems, and then one statement by John Grauber, who was on teaching staff here for many years in the 70s. One, all of you know The Road Not Taken. I don't think I have to read it to you, except that a choice has to be made. Interesting thing as a footnote is that, you know, I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere here, ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And he says it with a sigh because actually the two are pretty much the same. But life is choices. We talked about that. Life is choices. And the other one is J. Alfred Prufrock, who T.S. Eliot's poem, who was not meant to be Prince Hamlet. What's the matter with Hamlet? Hamlet can't make up his mind and act. Right? And the whole story is, the whole play is, when is Hamlet going to kill that uncle of his?
Yeah.
Just do it. It's kind of, it's just about tears you apart during that play, you know. Anyway, and Prufrock never gets to make up his mind either. He's, you know, he's trying to figure out how to go downstairs, and, you know, will people notice my bald spot, and do I dare eat a peach? And, it's just, you know, and at the end, he says, I grow old, I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled, you know. Oh, good. and then I have heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think that they will sing to me. John Graber has a great line where he says that of the two roads that diverged in Frost's yellow wood, J. Alfred Prufrock, with his teacups and his coffee spoons, dropped his butt on the fork. He never makes up his mind. He drops his butt on the fork. Okay, well, just think about that today. The whole, but getting up and actually doing anything. Walking is, the best definition I heard of walking was when I was in ninth grade. I had a crazy science teacher who was about 85, it seemed to me, and had bright blonde hair. Her name was Miss Harlow, and so she was, you know, Jean Harlow. She looked like she was playing a part herself, and she wore golden slippers. Anyway, but she said, walking is a series of falls and recoveries. That's what walking is. You know, when you think about how do kids walk? Well, they fall down, and then they get up, and they walk. They fall down, and they get up, and they walk. And that's we do that so often. I've used that for people with cooking. You know, you're always trying to recover when you're cooking. Yeah.
Can I say something about walking?
Yeah, say it.
Doesn't really, but just before I came, I had dinner with a former foster son who's Vietnamese, and he just bought a house. And he said, I found in my house, I'm walking with my heels, and it makes a click, click noise. And ever since I came to the U.S., I walked on my toes to be invisible.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
and,
a disguise,
and buying
too.
His house, and he now feels...
He can walk, yes. He can stroll, as we're using that word peripateo for strolling. He owns it. There's a story about the... this is a joke. This guy is sent down to hell, and he's roaming around hell and just lolling about, enjoying himself, and Satan's watching this and thinking, who is this guy? What? He's sort of finding out from his angels, what's this guy doing? He looks like he's royalty. You know, so finally Satan gets really upset and goes over to this guy and says, excuse me, mister, but you're walking around this place like you own it. And the guy says, I do. My wife gave it to me. But that's kind of how we walk around the world. You know, when St. Paul says in Corinthians, all things are yours. You're penniless and you own the world. And so let's get up and go. And those three stories from Acts that we used on Monday, you know, Philip and Lydia and St. Paul in the sinking ship. I mean, when you think about the ship is sinking, and here's Paul putting on a banquet, you know, and he says, take courage, and the feeling in Acts, of course, where we can't go back because we've all got fire on our heads, right? So it's hard to go back inside. We're going to look at a little bit today. We're going to look at people who want to go back into their little cells. And those of you who have Bibles can look up Galatians. I've also got some, for those of you who want to just notice that Galatians is in fact a letter. It's not very long. It's one of the longest of Paul's letters. But if anybody just wants to grab a sheet and look at it, that'd be just fine.
It looks like small print.
Yeah, it is small print. That's the problem. Paul says at the end, look with what large letters I'm writing, but it doesn't help. Print that I've got is so small. Galatians is, Luther calls Galatians my Katie von Bora. It's my Katie. Yeah, Katie's Luther's wife. And you kind of wonder, it's kind of an angry letter, sort of the angry letter to the editor that St. Paul writes in to these people. But they have exasperated him so much because they want to go back. They want to go back to jail. If you just look at 5, we talked about what faith was. Faith is the readiness to enter confidently into the darkness of the future. Look at look at chapter 5. I don't want to spend, I want you just to read it whenever you get a chance, and it may not be now, it may be a long time in the future. But look at 5. Verse 7. 5, verse 7. Because I just want you to notice. Oh, sorry, I'm not on 5, verse 7. Because that's you were running well. Well, actually, they were running, yeah, exactly. They were running. That's good that I remembered that. That they had, in fact, gotten up and were taking off. So I wanted to show that up because the feeling is that if they're running, why did they go back into their prison cell? And it's not that it's remember at the end of this is when he's going to say they want you to play a part. And remember the Orwell quote we used earlier about we grow into our masks. We can't help ourselves. If we're going to have a mask, we're going to grow into it. What I want to look it up is in the third chapter, the 23rd verse. And I want you to notice what the subject of that sentence is. Because we tend to think that faith is something that we manufacture. And when we talk on Friday about koinonia, we're going to see that faith is something that has absolutely nothing to do with us. It's all gift. Somebody want to read that about the through the 28th verse. You can almost do it by heart, especially the last verses.
Now, before faith came, we were confined under law, kept under restraint until faith should be revealed, so that the law was our custodian until Christ came, that we may be justified by faith. But now that faith had come, we are no longer under a custodian. For in Christ Jesus we are all sons of God through faith. For as many of you as were baptized unto Christ have been put on Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can just do 28 too, because that's...
There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for all are one in Christ Jesus.
Amen. What's the subject of that 23rd? You see, the faith came. Before faith came, we were, and the word is imprisoned, we were confined in a small space. It's a great scene in those of you who have read Viktor Frankl's book on where, what is it called?
Meaning of Life.
Man's search for meaning.
Thank you. Yeah. Meaning of life sounds a little better now.
Where
he finally gets out of concentration camp, and at first he can't believe it. I mean, so they kind of go back in. There's no place for them to go. They go out the first day, and they see these flowers, and they see this freedom, but they can't deal with it. It takes him several weeks, and then finally he's out there and he says, "You've brought me into a large space." He quotes Psalm 51. You know, wow. I mean, everything suddenly is new for him. And part of his mission in life for the next 40 years was for people to embrace newness. He couldn't be pulled back into the concentration camp because that would kill him. He had to move forward, and so he made it his mission in his, he's a psychiatrist, and to get people to face what they went through, but then to go forward. It's really, really hard, and I remember one of my dad's stories about on the other side of the world, my parents and my sister were freed by the Americans coming into the middle of the Battle of Manila and freeing all these prisoners in Bilibid prison, and all of them were starving to death, and it was horrible. But they were free. And the second night, my dad was awakened by one of the commanders and one of the doctors who was with the new their new commanders, who were in fact their liberators, and he said, "You have to help us. There's somebody we just can't reach. He isn't wounded, but he doesn't want to realize that he's free." So they went to another part of the prison, and here was in the makeshift infirmary was this soldier just kept saying, "Let me die, let me die." And his friends were all around him, people who shared horrendous imprisonment under the Japanese for 4 years, and they kept saying, "You're free, you're free, you're free." And he just kept saying, "Let me die, let me die, let me die." And he died. He could not realize he was free. And this is what's happening to the Galatians. They keep going back into their former life. They know what's going to happen there. And that's part of the challenge in Galatians. Paul is going to say in the fifth chapter, "For freedom, Christ has set you free." Period. Now, there are different kinds of freedom, and we'll talk about that later. But that's really hard to accept when you're used to being in prison. Why is it so hard? Well, have any of you been in prison for any length of time? Do you have friends who've been in prison?
I've spent a lot of time interviewing people in prison, yeah. So I've been in environment.
Holden Village used to have a number of people who came over from Shelton because John O'Neill, who became the chaplain there. Now there is, in fact, an Evangelical Lutheran church in Shelton, in the facility. It's over in the Olympic Peninsula. And it's a congregation, it's a place that where people are free in the gospel even though they're in prison. And it does amazing work. But a lot of people who were on parole in the early 70s would be coming here. And it became kind of a test to see if they could live in this halfway house. But for some of them, this was more of a prison than prison ever was. It gave them some freedom. You couldn't, you know, this is freedom. Yeah.
Isn't that Solzhenitsyn's first circle where the guy finally gets out of the gulag and then he can't take it?
Yeah, yeah, there is that story, right?
Can't be free.
Yeah. Well, in Solzhenitsyn, of course, the only people who are free in the Soviet Union are the people in the gulag.
The gulag, right.
They're free.
Yeah, in that one.
And we, you know, and Jesus says in the Beatitudes, the meek, you know, how do the meek inherit the earth? Well, they're the most imprisoned people. They can still ask questions, though. They're imprisoned in the right way, maybe, by being humiliated. And they're Jesus for us. I couldn't get online to hand out anything except for that little handout, so they'll just have to give me a moment. The challenge in Corinthians is going to follow the church around throughout its history. There's a straight line from Galatians to Dostoevsky's The Grand Inquisitor. What do we want? We want security. That's pretty much, those of you who know the story of The Grand Inquisitor know that it's a fable that's told by one of the brothers, Karamazov, and he tells it to another, and the brother who's telling it is an atheist, but he tells this story about Jesus coming back in the middle of the Spanish Inquisition, and Jesus comes back and heals people, and everybody's so excited, and the Grand Inquisitor is coming by with his entourage, and he just points, and everybody's terrified, and he has Jesus sent to prison. And in the middle of the night, the old Inquisitor comes down to see Jesus, and Jesus is silent the whole time, and the Grand Inquisitor pretty much gives a tirade about what Jesus has done by giving people freedom when they never wanted freedom. They wanted bread. They would rather have chains and bread, you know, bread and chains, rather than freedom and the possibility. I don't think we can, we'll spend all day on the Grand Inquisitor, but just read that part. And Dostoevsky saw what St. Paul was struggling with, which was what God is now asking instead of what do you want. God's become human, and we don't want what God has offered, which is life and that abundantly, according to John. Those of you who, since none of us have been in prison, we alas, last year at Koinonia, we had our cook had to go to prison. It was really terrible to have to do that. We didn't arrest him. He'd been stealing from guests at Koinonia for 24 years.
Oh.
And staff members had accused each other, and management had, you know, people had gone out under a cloud because, and all the time it was this lovely guy, John, you know, who had been on the street, but now he was, you know, at Koinonia. Koinonia imprisoned him in a terrible way. If anybody was in Prufrock's a phrase, formulated in a phrase, pinned and wriggling on the wall, that's what J. Alfred Prufrock feels he is. It was John. He was a terrible cook. He just opened packages. And then during meals and during worship, he would get into people's rooms and take their money. And usually he only took $20 or $40. Some people didn't know. But that it had gone on so terribly long, and it started in the first years when there were people who were out of prison, who were trying to stay out of prison, and they were up at Koinonia, just as Olden Village used to have a program like that. And of course, everybody suspected the parolees, and not John. He's, oh dear. Anyway, prison might have been the best thing for him. He had to be freed from his, he had to be freed of his icon status at Koinonia. But he has a long, long way to walk. And I just want you to hold him in your prayers, because I don't know how that story is going to end. But the odd thing was, the people who were most furious were the people who made a mask for John. John was the one we'd taken from the streets and made into this wonderful, you know. Oh, he's so friendly to everybody. And well, of course, he was friendly. He was checking them out. But it was really hard. The week he got out of jail very fast, which was good. Get out of jail, you know, pay $200, and that's it. But, oh, dear, we had a couple of sermons, one especially where this one pastor was so angry with the congregation that was there, basically just tore into Tom and Carol and Paul. We'd only been there for 2 months, you know. All we'd noticed was that there was a huge, huge grocery bill that didn't seem to work right, that the food costs were 95% of what the... I mean, something was obviously wrong. And then the weekend John was in jail, I came into the kitchen early on Monday morning. All the pots and pans and every Everything that was made of metal in the kitchen had been stolen. Okay. There was nothing to make breakfast with. It was just on and on. It got worse and worse. Anyway, but this pastor was so furious that someone I have used as an example for years in my preaching, and you took him away. Anyway, okay. So you never know that it isn't just us. It's not just, we're not the only ones who want to be imprisoned. The group wants us to be imprisoned. They want us to act in the way we've always acted. So the last part that Mike read there says, you're new. You're not male and female. To think about the roles males and females were in, slaves and free, you mean slaves can act like free people? One of the things from last night's session that Jason had the first thing that a lot of states did once they could and was say that black and white people couldn't marry. That was, to make sure. You think, wowie, it says right here that we're all one in Christ. But that's the first thing, because you have to make sure somebody conforms to what the group, what the country thinks. And with John, I don't know if John's going to be able to get to become himself. I don't know where the person is there, because for so long, this family called Koinonia relegated him to the status of the homeless kid who made good. And there we all are. When you read Galatians, and from the very beginning, unlike the rest of Paul's letters, he doesn't say he gives thanks for them every time he remembers them, as he does to the Philippians. He doesn't say to all the saints that are in Corinth. Which he does in Corinth. When you think about all the horrible things the Corinthians are doing, Paul still says to the saints that are in Corinth. He doesn't. But here, the first thing he says is, I am astonished. I am flabbergasted, is the closest we can get, that you are deserting. You think about deserting. Paul in Romans is talking in the sixth chapter about how we have been buried with Christ, all of those things, and what, and these people basically, have dug themselves out of that into, and have deserted the cause. With Paul being so angry, people always bring up that he tells that people who are troubling them, they can castrate themselves if they're trying to circumcise the rest of them. I mean, this is somebody who's really upset about it. That's not in the first chapter, though. But I just want you to know that Paul has to have a defense about who he is. And again, Paul had to defend his ministry. And this is one of the longest defenses in the first, end of the first chapter and the beginning of the second. And especially, one of the few times we get an idea of what was happening in the early church. And for this we have hope, because one of the mantras at Holden Village is the gospel lives by controversy. And if you read the book of Acts, the term, it seemed good to us. Well, we'll have this discussion. And here something major really happened in Antioch. And if you look at the middle of the second chapter, from the 11th verse on, Cephas comes to Antioch, and Paul says, I had to confront him. Because before, certain people came from James in Jerusalem. Well, James seems to be the head of the church, according to Acts. Peter ate with us. Now, here we have this summer's breaking of the bread. Remember, on Monday, Paul broke bread and gave it to everyone, was blessed on that sinking ship, even the sailors who had tried to desert the ship and run away. Everybody's involved in the meal, in the gift, and nobody, not a hair on your head is going to remember that, not a hair on your head is going to remember. Here we have table fellowship. This is so important that there's table. They're breaking bread together. And then there are categories. And lots of scholars through the ages tried to make this, this is somehow before the council in Jerusalem, and how do we work this out so we work with Acts? I don't know if we can. The big argument in the early, late 4th and early 5th century was between Jerome and St. Augustine. And Jerome said, well, Peter and Paul were just play acting at this, just to show. And Augustine said, no, this is really, really at the center of the life of the new church, is how we welcome people. How do we welcome people? Beginning of the letter to Thessalonians, Paul's going to say, what a welcome you gave. Everybody has heard, what a welcome you gave. You know, it's huiohodos. It's just the way you did that. It's like he's cheering. And alas, in English, it says, you know, what manner of welcome you gave. Everybody's talking about it. Oh, those ginger snaps were something else. And, no, I mean, that's the kind of idea that happens we're all going to go down to the fellowship hall and do the same thing. Look at the extended tirade here, not from the Grand Inquisitor, but from Paul, saying that we can't go back to that little room. We can't go back to that jail cell. We're out of it. We don't know what happened at the end because he stops telling the story. And we don't know who won that argument. In time, the church in Antioch, of course, was a center for all sorts of wondrous theological work, and nobody reads it anymore, and it's probably just as well. The third chapter, though, is where we get this. Here's this old. This was written for O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? Amazing thing is, in 2004, I'm picking up fish in Minneapolis, and the old fishmonger there, I thought he was old, he was just my age now, but he was nearing retirement, and he's the fish cutter, and he said, you know, I just realized, you're Paul Hinderly. In 1957, I was in Missoula, Montana. And we had to be, you know, they did this long spiel. It's amazing what happens when you're young. And he said, I read Galatians. Oh, foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? This is written by a guy named Thomas Males. He became famous in later life. He's a terrific chronicler of the Plains Indians. He's kind of he had about 12 books out on, especially on the Cheyenne. It was a really wondrous scholar of the Plains culture, but if you were a 16-year-old and somebody handed you this book, you'd probably look at it. You might never read the book, but you'd keep looking at the cover. Anyway, he was an artist too, and sort of was a precursor of Dan Erlander. Dan remembers this book too. It's in the library. But who has bewitched you? Now, remember, we're back to Genesis 3. You know, the questions, you know, where are you? What have you done? In the middle of that is sort of, you know, who have you been listening to? Who, and Adam and Eve sort of try to get off on the bewitched thing. Oh, I don't know, you know, if you read it in the Greek, I think that he doesn't use the word bewitched, but there is this idea that, You know, we were conned into this anyway.
She did it.
Yeah, well, that's of course Adams. Yeah. Thank you for mentioning that. But in 3:2, did you receive the Spirit? No, he only wants to know one thing. He said, "I just want to know one thing." Did you receive the Spirit because of your work or because of a faith hearing? It says some places say hearing and believing. It's a hearing. It's a faith hearing. And then, just as in Roman, in the book of letter to the Romans, he goes back to Abraham and tells the story of Abraham. He does this as well in Galatians. And then he says an interesting thing in 19, and a lot of people, if Calvin would have been better off if he realized that St. Paul not only loved to walk, because he was always on the way and was strolling, but he seems to have known an awful lot about sports. So 3:19, what do people have everybody gets caught up on the being delivered by angels, but he's going to say in 19, what do you have? I've got it in Latin here and in a Roman translation that's a little odd.
Why then the law?
And then what's next?
It was added because of transgressions until the offspring would come to whom the promise had been made, and it was ordained through angels by a mediator.
Okay. So you have transgressions there?
Yes.
And is that what most people have?
That's what I think.
Yeah, transgressions.
Well, the word is actually is actually boundaries. It's a sports word. You're out of bounds. The law was enacted because we are in community and we go out of bounds. And now in interpersonal things, we see that all the time when somebody's in your face. We have ideas of personal boundaries we talk about. Paul is saying the law is there because the community went out of bounds, because boundaries were transgressed. Not because of transgressions, thou shalt not. If you think about the Ten Commandments, you know, the second table of the law is set up to try to work out how do you live in community, you know. Can you live in a community where you have adultery? That can be challenging. Can you live in community where you have stealing, where you have killing, where you have coveting each other's goods? Paul is saying, this is why there's the law. He's got a really, really down-to-earth idea of what the law can do, right? There's one other place where he talks about the law, and that's further on in 23. So that's the one use of the law is basically we go out of bounds. The second use of the law is in 23. This is how we're going to walk, how we walk in community. The law is still good for that. It keeps us from going out of bounds. And not that, you know, we have to make sure we're not, you know, sowing in, you know, putting flax into wool or something, or, you know, doing all sorts of things. Or Paul doesn't seem to care even about the Sabbath. But if you look at 23, before we were, remember, about the faith, the next part is what Mike read earlier, that the law was our custodian. It was our custodian. And the word for that, and we've talked about that a little in the past, but the word isn't custodian. It's actually a word for a slave who brought the boys of the well-to-do adults The slave was employed bringing the boys to school. And it's an odd word that we still use. It's pedagogus. We get the word pedagogue from it. A pedagogue is a boring teacher. Well, these slaves never even made it to be boring teachers. Their job was just to take the boys to school. And Plato has one of the dialogues, Socrates is very upset with these pedagogues who've gotten drunk in the afternoon on wine, and how are they going to bring the boys back home? So, you know, that's an interesting question, but since we don't have slaves bringing boys or girls to school anymore, the closest thing I've come up with is a school bus. Basically, the law is a school bus. It gets you to school. The law doesn't get us to the gospel, especially in a positive way. It tells us that we're screw-ups. It tells us in a negative way, you know, what have you done? I'm a screw-up. Every time, you know, with Al-Anon, with AA, you know, you have to come up against that. You're not only an alcoholic, it's also, what have you done? You have to make those amends because you've been driven to your knees. The law will get you there. Luther and Kierkegaard both have that quote about just try to keep the law. Just try to keep one commandment for one day. It'll drive you to your knees. Try to keep one commandment. You end up looking at yourself all day. Have I kept that commandment? One of the challenges is that the church has gotten so good. And so in the 7th chapter of Romans, when Paul says, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me? You know, a lot of scholars say, well, he's talking about Adam. He's not talking about it. According to this, we're part of that. Paul at the end is going to say, if anybody's overtaken in a sin, you know, as if you were bewitched again, you are going to get tripped up. It's going to be part of your walk in this life. But we have a God, and that's in the community, according to Paul. As you read the 5th and 6th chapters, you'll see that that's what the koinonia is about lifting us up and pulling us each out of ditches. How is God going to do that? He's going to have to do it. How am I going to get pulled out of the ditch? You're going to have to do it. You're going to have to be Jesus for me. And that's can mean just accompanying, as we talked about the story about one of the staffers who shared this week. That's all people did when he first came to this village 5 years ago, and he was in a lot of trouble, and all people did was accompany him. And he went out with good courage and did whatever he had to do. But a lot of it had to do with examining what he had done. And nobody up here knew what he had done, but you listened. And whether you were here for 5 years ago or not, doesn't make any difference. You accompanied this person. And that works with people who have broken hearts as well. And one of the stories that I like to tell with people who are broken concerns 2005, the village here was having a very hard time at Christmas, just celebrating. And we would not have gotten, Tom and Carol and I would not have gotten through that year if it hadn't been for Steph and Chuck were still here. I didn't know how we were going to minister to people over Christmas. It seemed that this village was so inward-looking and was, as the president of St. Olaf College back in the 30s used to say, that the favorite indoor sport of Norwegians is picking the lint out of their spiritual belly buttons. And that's sort of what we're doing. We're picking it out of each other's spiritual belly buttons, too. It was a full-time job. But this woman came up, And people accompanied her. They had no idea what her story was, you know. So Steph became a friend of hers right away. And did you ever hear her story? I don't think you did.
I have no idea who you were talking about.
See, that's what I mean. Isn't that great? That's going to happen on the last day. Jesus is going to say, you're going to say, when did I do this? Well, this woman, and as she was going out, I was with her on the boat going down, and she said, well, I suppose you could tell that I was really having, you know, that I was really having a lot of issues. And I said, no. She said, said, well, you know, I work at Microsoft, and it's a, you know, I didn't want to talk about that. I said, well, there's lots of people work at Microsoft, and they come to Bolton Village, and nobody points it. Well, some people might have been here, might have pointed it out that they worked at Microsoft. She said, well, I really needed to come to a place because I've been, actually, I've just started working at Microsoft this fall, and for the last 4 years, I've been flying helicopter in Iraq, and I've been having such a challenging time. So we talked about that you know, Holden's, at that time, Holden's ministry to veterans wasn't very active. Anyway, and then there was this long pause, and she said, well, you know, the real reason why I wanted to come, I had to go someplace for Christmas. She said, my parents, last summer, right before I was coming home, my parents were on a canoe trip in Alaska, and they were attacked and eaten by bears. Mm. And I was going to say, oh, I read that in the Wenatchee Daily World. Fortunately, I didn't say anything. She didn't want me to say anything. And nobody up here, she hadn't told that story to anybody. But she said, you know, the amazing thing was that I felt so loved by everyone here. I can go out. I didn't think I was going to make it through Christmas. I didn't want to go anywhere. And a friend just said, go to Holden Village. There are lots of people up there who are by themselves. And anyway, she came back a few times over the years, and I don't know where can I go? That old Bill Clinton story, you know, of when he was having one of his troubles, and he was coming out of the White House on a Sunday morning, and the press corps quickly assembled, and, you know, and they said, where are you going? And he said, Bill Clinton said, I'm going to church. And one of the reporters said, you're going to church? And Bill Clinton said, where else can I go? Now, he had a great church. And Holden Village is this great koinonia with people who are beaten down, people whose hearts are broken, people who have screwed up, can come to this place. And the challenge is, for us, is not to formulate them in a phrase and put them back into prison as they go out. The great thing about Holden, we don't have a church. Nobody has to act especially good. In fact, we can be sinners. We have a hard time with people like the John Sadas who steal from, but I don't want to go there. There are still, that doesn't mean you're not accountable for what you do. It's just that, you know, St. Paul is trying to deal, and he's not a saint yet, that comes several centuries later. As Paul is trying to deal with these people he loves very much, he's trying to get them to look honestly at who they are, what they've done. And then there's this final whose they are, you know, because as I come to know Jesus, or as I come to know the Lord, or no, I have come to be known again and again, just as that little faith is the subject of that sentence. Again and again, Paul is saying that it's all a gift. It's the faith of Jesus. It's Jesus who knows me and loves me and accepts me and died for me. So it's not I who live, but Christ who lives in me. As many who are in Christ have put on Christ. The clothing we wear now is Christ. And that means something that I hadn't read until Peter Brown pointed it out. He's a great scholar of the later Roman Empire, and that Christians were accused of having a single heart, that they were not divided. And that was both something that was, damned as far as the society was concerned, but in time became cherished. And of course then the church lost it, the Christians lost it, the same double heart, because we had to be good. What's the first thing that a church council tells a prospective pastoral candidate who may call to be pastor? I've heard it so often. Well, they're all good people here. Well, then what are they doing in church if they're good? We have a God who knows us and who loves us and who's died for us, and we get to do that loving in this world. Well, I have left the end of Galatians for you to read and to realize that the only thing that makes a difference is this new creation that is Christ Jesus. And that's where we'll leave it. And enjoy this time of strolling around. Tomorrow we're going to do a little stroll through John, because I think we've spent the last day and a half on Paul and the first day on Acts. And we'll come back on tomorrow with all under the guiding hand of the peripatetic Jesus and God in Genesis 3. Thank you, Jesus.